My guest today says there is an iron law of failure that governs all human-made entities, corporations, societies, and even governmental programs. The world economy, he says, doesn't tick along in perfect rhythm according to the best-laid plans of any individual, but happens much more haphazardly. With him today, we'll probe the reasons for the failure of brands, entire companies, and public policies. I'm Bill Hammack, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or you can call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine economist Paul Ormerod.
Hi.
Paul, the key observation in your book is a connection between biological extinction and the failure of corporations. And this is what, in a way, got you started. What did you see when you compared those two phenomena?
Well, I think there are lots of very interesting comparisons between the two. In particular, there's a lot of research being done in the last 10 or 15 years about patterns of extinction in the biological fossil record. And lots of new discoveries, interesting discoveries, have been made. Although evolution itself, as we know, proceeds at random, there are very clear patterns of extinction that sometimes, very, very rarely, we observe very large extinctions, for example, like when the dinosaurs became extinct. But most of the time, you know, in most time periods in biological history, the extinction rate's been fairly low. And yet, remarkably, when we look at, of course, the timescales are completely different, but when we look at databases of, say, extinctions of companies, whether it's in America or in the countries of Europe, we see the same sort of patterns. We see periods when large proportions of firms, say, in an industry or a state or a country, become extinct, and yet most of the time, you know, the extinction rate of firms is fairly low. So there are some very deep parallels between the two, and that's what got me, you know, really interested in the whole thing. Why is this the case?
So what is it, though, when you say there are certain patterns in extinction, yeah, what is it that you observe? I mean, is it a bell-shaped curve that you observe?
Oh, no, certainly not. It's completely different. It's not the standard curve you might expect of the sort of normal distribution when you don't get very many rare events. It's something which there's an awful lot of really exciting work going on in this area, not just in economics or biology, but also in the physical sciences. And it's a particular relationship which it just happens to be called a power law. There's no significance in the words itself, but it's just that's how it's described. And it's a particular relationship, which means that although, if you like, very big events, very big extinctions or very big share price changes, for example, are rare, they're much more frequent than you observe under the bell curve. You know, I mean, people have come very unstuck on financial markets, haven't they, over the last 10, 15 mm-hmm. years, by the fact that we do see large changes in stock markets, for example, they're very rare, they're only every few years. According to if they followed a bell-shaped curve, we wouldn't observe them in the lifetime of the universe. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of power law there in terms of the distribution of large stock prices, both up and down. The internet connections on the internet, for example, think of the different the sites, the way people connect. Some sites have lots and lots and lots of hits, you know, huge numbers of hits. Most sites have relatively few. And it's that same statistical relationship that we can find in biological extinction, firm extinction, the internet. There's a whole range of things where people are finding identical patterns around in completely different disciplines.
So what you mean here, if I understand you correctly, is that unlike a bell-shaped curve where it's evenly distributed, you'll see long stretches, for example, with few extinctions in biology, and then a huge spike in the extinction rate.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what you see. If you plot it over time, if you say let's plot the you know, the extinction rate in biology over time, over the hundreds of millions of years for which the fossil record exists, most of the time it seems to be moving along at random at pretty low levels. And then you'll see some medium-sized spikes, and then just occasionally, what appears to be at random, you'll see some very large spikes. But when you like twist the data around and turn it into a distribution, what you see there is exactly this. There is a very distinct pattern in what appears to be just irregular movements. And I say you can find the same sort of thing in people are finding the same relationship in a whole range of things.
So, you know, you mentioned websites. I think what you meant there for a power law is a few websites may have thousands or even millions of links, but yes, most of them have very few or none. Is that the key observation?
Exactly. That's right. What we're looking at, okay, there's many systems that, you know, there's a few which have large numbers of whether it's extinct periods of extinction, sites with lots of hits, and most of the time, most things have very little.
So,
that's exactly right.
All right, you noticed in this relationship between biological extinction and between failure rates of corporations and other things. Now I want to understand how this helped you as an economist to understand certain failures. For example, can you apply this to a marketing failure?
Oh, well, yes, I think, in a sense, companies, understand this intuitively. They might not know about power laws, but they understand instinctively. You know, that most of the things that they try out, no matter how carefully researched they are, often fail. So companies are always innovating. So if you think a look at, say, individual brands, you know, even successful ones, companies are always trying different strategies, you know, different variants of the brand, even in, say, you know, very well-established mature markets and simple ones like, say, candy bars. You know, the people will all, the manufacturers will always be trying different variants of a brand, and they'll test it with in a variety of ways, with panels, consumer panels, and so forth. And they'll try not to fail, but there, nevertheless, we see at a brand level, most brands that are introduced actually fail. And if we think of, especially in new technology industries, most of the firms that try and enter these markets actually end up failing. So you think, for example, of just to give an illustration of that, say, the car market. Now, of course, at the moment, this is quite interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, the American car giants, if you'd said, you know, 30 years ago, you know, Ford and General Motors would be in serious trouble, people simply wouldn't have believed it. But if we go back a century to when the market was first being developed, you know, when we think of the car market, we typically think of, you know, a small number of very, very large firms. But in the first 20 years of the 20th century, you know, around 2,000 different companies tried to make cars in America. And by 1920, of course, most of them had disappeared. And that's typical of what happens in industries, particularly, I said, those with new technologies. You know, the internet boom and telecom boom of the late 90s was exactly the same sort of thing. And we can see examples from much earlier in economic history, exactly the same thing going on.
I'm talking today to Paul Omerand, author of Why Most Things Fail, Evolution, Extinction, and Economics. And he argues that the world economy doesn't tick along in a perfect rhythm, according to the best laid plans of any individual, but that it happens much more haphazardly. And so we're going to look more at the reasons for failure of brands, corporations, companies, and even public policies in a minute. Paul, you know, you mentioned failure of marketing and failure of corporations here. In fact, when you talk about economic failure, you cast your net very wide, and you look at a host of very complex systems. You look at societies, you look at corporations, government programs. Can you give me an idea of these kind of failures, starting with corporations? You are mentioning some numbers about how corporations have failed.
Yeah.
If we look at from the turn of the century today, have large numbers of corporations actually failed?
Oh, yes. Well, typically in America. But don't forget, most companies are actually very small, but even large ones become extinct as well. But typically, if we can think about it that way, around just over 10% of all American companies disappear every year. And it's the same thing. It's remarkable. It's very similar in Europe. You know, there are lots of differences between the American and European economies, but we see the same thing here. You know, just over 10% of companies on average, I mean, it varies enormously, of course, from year to year, but they disappear. And even very, very large ones. There's a very interesting study done by an economic historian looking at the 100 largest firms in the world in just before the First World War. And these were the first, you know, really multinational firms in world history. You know, they were just stupendously bigger than anything that had gone before. They've been created in a massive merger movement right at the start of the 20th century. And yet, By the mid-90s, this is where his research goes to, you know, over half of them had disappeared. And these are firms which, you know, were as big relative to the size of the economy as, say, you know, Microsoft is now. These are really giant companies, many of which have, in the intervening years, disappeared, you know, taking up billions of dollars of shareholders' funds with them.
Mm-hmm.
So very large companies do disappear. Very small companies disappear. And it's a very wide range. It's a very wide ranging phenomenon. So it doesn't just apply to America. It seems to be the same in every developed country that we've actually looked at.
And could you give me an example of a kind of government program failure that you're thinking about?
Well, I mean, in a sense, I mean that's
just a few.
That's even there are so many examples there.
But what's a paradigm?
There are many. Governments have tried to do a huge range of things. You know, much more so than they ever used to do. Perhaps if I could give a contrast here with, say, unemployment rates, say, in Europe with those in America. I mean, sometimes things succeed, but, you know, there's been much more concern, much more worry about, say, unemployment in Europe and much more active, you know, strategies taken to try to deal with it, you know, for decades, and yet it's, you know, it remains very high in countries like Germany and France and so forth. People don't really seem to be able to do anything about it. That's an absolutely obvious one. But even at the micro level, you know, we can see all sorts of programs to try to, if you like, improve the social and economic chances of poor people, for example, or policies to try to remove inequalities in gender and race. And we see these things, you know, persisting over decades, despite, you know, the good intentions of policymakers.
I encourage our callers to call today. I'm talking to Paul Omeron, author of Why Things Fail. You can reach me at 333-WILL, or if you're in the outside of the area, you can call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And so the kind of last thing on the failures that you look at is societies. I mean, what do you mean by a failure of society? Is that more than just a government program failing?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, I'm taking a broad sweep here, but if you look at it and see, you know, I mean, it's like, I mean, humans invented cities, you know, whatever it is, you know, 8,000, 10,000 years ago, and we've tried all sorts of different social structures. You know, all sorts of government systems, all sorts of economic systems. And the only one that's been, you know, really tremendously successful is the one that we've got now. And people, you know, there are criticisms of it on the environmental front. But compared to all other forms of economic and social organisation we've had before, you know, a combination of, you know, a market-oriented system with liberal democracy is just fantastically successful. You know, it's incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. And yet it's really the only one, you know, that humans, if you like, have managed to evolve in a space of, you know, 10,000 years, ever since we just stopped being hunter-gatherers and started to live in cities and, you know, start to become civilized. It's taken us a long time to work out how, you know, to really deliver benefits for everybody.
Well, first of all, let's turn to a caller. We have a caller in Champaign-Urbana on line one. Line one, please go ahead.
Hi, any data on investment companies in Scotland over 100 years ago? Someone took in a lot of cash and was sitting on it, and the market crashed, and then he was considered a genius because he had all his cash intact and everyone had lost. But now there's like 12,000 investment companies in the States, and do you see any trends in that?
Oh, well, I mean, there are lots of reverse examples there, aren't there? I mean, there's a guy over here who became he was famous for being sacked about three weeks before the market crashed in 2000 because he was running a big fund and kept saying, well, the market's overvalued, I'm keeping all my clients in cash. And it turned out he was right in the end, but, you know, he lost his job about 3 weeks beforehand. So, it's well established, isn't it? I mean, at fund performance, it's very hard for, there are some people who occasionally appear to, beat the trend on average over the long run, but it's very difficult. Seems to be a very, very difficult thing to do, and most people, averaging things out, just go along with the market.
Paul, we need to pause here for a weather update, so I'll turn to Tom Rogers for just a moment and then return to talk with you.
All right. We have been talking about the potential for severe weather this afternoon, and now the Storm Prediction Center has issued a tornado watch for portions of central and southern Illinois, and effective until 9 o'clock tonight. Tornadoes, hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the tornado watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Christian, DeWitt, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby, so counties to the south and west of Champaign. Remember, a tornado watcher means that conditions are favorable for tornadoes and severe thunderstorms in and close to the watch area. Now is the time to think about what you would do should a tornado or severe thunderstorm rapidly approach. Also, keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions, and stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. Again, a tornado watch is in effect for portions of central and southern Illinois, including Christian, DeWitt, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby counties until 9 o'clock tonight.
I'm talking to Paul Omerod on the Afternoon Magazine. He's an economist who wrote a book called Why Most Things Fail, Evolution, Extinction, and Economics. And I invite your questions at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Well, Paul, if I could play devil's advocate just for a moment here. I mean, you mentioned that things fail and corporations fail. One would think that a corporation like Microsoft would really epitomize the thinking, rational, calculating strategy of success. And so my question for you is, do they? Do they counter what you've been telling us?
Oh, well, not really, actually. It's very interesting. I mean, Microsoft is obviously phenomenally successful, and, all credit to the people who, had the insight, Bill Gates and his original founders. They had the insight many years ago that personal computers would be, become absolutely key. And in fact, if we remember, just stepping back about those 20 years, IBM didn't realize that at the time. Even the IBM giant, which had dominated the world computer market, they almost failed. They almost, went under because they hadn't anticipated the impact of the personal computer and remained stuck in the mainframe mindset. Now, many people won't remember this, but in the 1980s, one way that IBM survived was by allying with Microsoft and trying to develop what both companies said would be the operating system for PCs of the future, which is something called OS 2. Now, copies of it may survive in museums, I don't know. And Microsoft continued to develop Windows, which wasn't terribly successful. And they decided to actually cut back their development team. And before Windows 3 was released in 1990, they actually made public statements and said, yes, once we release Windows 3, of course, you can still want to buy it if you want to do, but we won't do any more development. And it sold something like 2 million copies in 3 or 4 months, and so they had to revamp their whole strategy. So they were going with a system called OS2 with IBM, when it suddenly turned out something they were trying to wind down turned out to be phenomenally successful. So, yes, they had a brilliant insight about the importance of PCs, but the way in which it was delivered ultimately through the Windows system actually was, if you like, most failures are unexpected, but this was a very unexpected success. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of business life is about that. It's a very spectacular example. But anybody who's been involved in running a firm, you sit down, you do your corporate plan, or you advise people on doing a corporate plan, and you do your business plan, whether you're a big company or a small company, and most of the time, things don't turn out exactly as you intend, whether for good or for bad. The outturn is usually different from what you've actually thought in the first place. And the Microsoft one, I think, is a pretty spectacular example of unexpected success.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is when we really get down and look at the micro level that, well, from the outside, first of all, it looks like they're, capting their ship in a particular way. But from the inside, it's much more like whitewater rafting than anything else.
Exactly. I think that's the point. I think, in companies, yes. I mean, obviously, you try to plan. You try to. Nobody intends to fail. People are sitting down and you try and make the best forecast you got for your sales or what advertising strategy you should have or what product you're trying to develop. But the outside world's so complex that it's impossible to understand everything what's going on. I mean, if I could give again stepping back a bit in time, but it's many people will remember it, a really spectacular failure in the mid 80s when Coca-Cola relaunched itself when it was coming under a very strong challenge from Pepsi for the number one slot. in that particular drinks market, and they spent a stupendous amount of money on consumer research on new Coke. They were convinced it was going to work, and yet once it was actually, despite what consumers had said in advance in all the tests, when it actually went on the market, it bombed spectacularly. And the Coca-Cola board had to get down and said, well, what are we going to do? And they took a big gamble and they withdrew it and then restored the old one, which with hindsight turned out to work. But they didn't know that in advance, and neither did they know that, you know, the new formula they were launching, despite the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it in advance, was going to fail. So things, you know, in businesses, you learn to expect the unexpected. You try to avoid it. You know, people are intending to succeed, but most of the time, the outturn, like I say, will often be different from what people intend, for both for good and for bad.
Let's go ahead and take a caller from Crystal Lake. So the caller on line four, please go ahead.
Yes. Besides the virus, in the last two presidential elections, the Diebold machines and maybe other electronic touchscreen machines could be hacked into. Now, how can we ever be sure that a machine owned by a corporation won't have some way of hacking into the vote, and also to show that it didn't, that there were lost votes in the last two presidential elections? The tallied votes did not agree with.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's a good point, because you can never, no matter how carefully you try to anticipate failure and try and prevent it from happening, I think it is virtually impossible. You can never really anticipate. I mean, think of the security worldwide now. I mean, they just what's going on? We've had some bombings over here. You know, people are there's some really clever people using really high tech stuff all the time, trying to anticipate and what's going to go on. And yet, occasionally, terrorist attacks get through. This evening, it's almost impossible to design something which is completely foolproof, and maybe that's one of the examples that you've just given.
Well, our caller very nicely led us kind of into larger political or social issues, and I wanted to talk to you about that too, because we talked about corporations quite a bit, but in your book, you even tackle why segregation in a society occurs, and by any number of ways, by income and by race, and you make a very interesting and provocative statement. You say, quote, "No single individual has intended or necessarily desires this overall outcome. They are only concerned with what happens in their own local area." And I wondered, could you explain what you mean by this, and how segregation then results?
Well, yes. Well, in fact, it's not. This is I'm describing in the book. A really brilliant piece of work by Thomas Schelling. He's an American. He's now in his mid-80s, and he very deservedly won the Nobel Prize in Economics last year. I mean, partly for his work on this about 25 years ago, also from other stuff. I mean, he looked at. If you look at, it's not just a question of American society. It's over in it's in Britain and France. It's in European societies as well. At a residential level, there is marked segregation. You mentioned partly on income, but also on racial lines. We do tend to see heavy concentrations of different racial groups. So we observe system-wide level. And you look at that, and an observer from Mars might say, well, this must prove that the individuals concerned in these societies have got very strong preferences to live like that. They don't like living, with people from different racial groups than themselves. But again, there's an awful lot of evidence. I mean, there are a few, bigots around, but most people, seem very relaxed. They're not as individuals. Most people as individuals, a huge amount of evidence to suggest that people aren't really biased. What happens is that this is the whole point of this new science of complexity that's coming along, and that mentioned earlier, all the different disciplines it's being applied to. You have a system where even though individuals only have a very mild preference to living with people of their own race or income levels or whatever, only a very mild preference, we can still get very marked segregation at the system-wide level. It's very hard to describe. It takes me a number of pages in the book to go out and why this is the case. And it's much more demonstrated by a couple of really smart charts, which actually bring it out very, very clearly. And I think this is one of the reasons why, if you like, political. It's because it's the interaction. You think about it. One way to think about it, if I try to describe it, is imagine people on a chessboard, and unless for the sake of argument, not to stereotype, people call them reds and blues or whatever, or greens and reds. And we scatter them around at random, and we have some simple moves, simple rules for, you know, people just look at their local neighborhoods. And as long as they're not in a minority, they're happy. But this simple rule is enough to bring about very rapidly very marked segregation. And it's these unintended consequences, if you like. It's like consequences it's very, very hard to anticipate, which results in an awful lot of political failures, I think, of particular schemes.
I'd like to take another caller. We have a caller from Champaign on line one. Line one, please go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I have a question. In relationship to the European social safety net, which seems to be much more vast than what's in this country, and England also. But often in the media here, it's expressed, oh, this is a drag on the European economies. It results in high unemployment for Europe and so forth and so forth. I think, well, that's my question. How much truth is there to that? Is there any truth to that? And I think that's probably my question. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, it's a very important question. I think one thing to say is, people contrast, you know, America and Europe, but within Europe itself, there are many, if you like, different types of capitalism, different types of market economies. There's very much the great diversity here, as well. I mean, like Sweden is diversity here, and interestingly, a lot of the apart from Britain, which is, you know, similar to America, a lot of the small European economies, like the Netherlands, Norway, whatever, you know, of experiences similar to the United States in unemployment. So I don't think that's, I mean, you know, I think each of these societies has got their strengths. I mean, I think the point I would say is, I want to come back to this, if Bill will let me, to make a more general point, is come back to this point that the market economies we've got, the Western system, is just incredibly successful, and different types of it, have their different strengths. But I would say, yes, I think there is a consensus over here, to answer your question specifically. There is a consensus over here amongst, you know, economists of all, almost all persuasions. The safety net, yes, I mean, it's a good thing in one sense, but it does seem to contribute to, you know, the higher unemployment rates on average we see in the larger European economy. So there does seem to be a fairly simple answer to your question, which, as I say, commands, you know, pretty broader sense over here.
I'm talking to Paul Ormerod, author of Why Things Fail. You can reach us at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Well, Paul, we've given a lot of examples of failure. Now I'd like to dig in a little deeper in your book to kind of the intellectual and philosophical underpinnings of it. Now, an undercurrent throughout the book is that most economists have blithely ignored failure, which you've shown is perhaps the one constant in life. Why do they do so?
This goes back a long way. You're right, but in most economics about, you know, how firms should operate, they're really talking about idealized firms in idealized worlds, and how they might make the best possible decision and how to succeed. But these are very much idealized worlds. And like I say, the world itself is, you know, incredibly complicated. I think there's a good reason for it, is that when the study of economics started, you know, really seriously about, say, 100-120 years ago, there were only certain types of tools. We had mathematics to try and analyze things. They could gather data and do some statistics. But the tools they had available weren't suitable for understanding, you know, very complex environments such as the economy. You know, you could only get at best in a sort of approximations to what was going on. So, for example, when I was talking earlier about Thomas Schelling's model on segregation, you know, we couldn't do that sort of thing, you know, without modern computers. You know, we can see patterns from, if you like, Schelling's understanding of segregation, you know, once he's had the insight about how to actually, if you like, create them and to devise the rules of his model, they can emerge much more rapidly through a computer. We can see the patterns, whereas, you know, if you don't have those tools available to you, you could work for decades and never see them. So I think it's because, you know, it was easy, if you like, to focus on success using certain types of mathematics, and that led you to think about success, to think about how, to use a word from economics, anybody who's done economics out there will recognize it, you know, optimal decisions, how do people and firms always make the very best possible decision in their own self-interest? And there are certain types of mathematics which lend themselves to give those sort of answers, but they aren't very realistic when it comes to understanding how the world itself really operates.
So what you're really saying here, I think, is that most economists use a kind of general equilibrium theory, where the resources are fixed, everyone's taste and preferences are fixed, and instead what we have to do is we have to introduce social process into that to a degree.
Yes, and I think to be fair, I think some of the very best economists, particularly in the United States, you know, are taking the subject in that area. There is a growing interest in, if you like, social processes and how individuals interact, how they influence each other with their behavior or the decisions, how they can change each other's tastes and preferences. So there's more and more interest in that. But you're right, yes, the bulk of economics as it stands, certainly in the textbooks, certainly as it's taught to almost all students, is in this idealized world where it is possible to take the best decision possible in your own self-interests. And all the complexities of the world, all the complexities of running businesses, making decisions in a political context, they're removed, and it's a dramatic simplification, which really is a really very poor one for actually understanding most of the time what goes on. But like I say, some of the top American economists are, like Schelling himself, for example, are thinking much more about how the world really does operate.
We now have a call from Charleston, Illinois. So caller on line 4, please go ahead.
Yes. I take a great deal of difference with your guest. As a Marxist, I view things from that perspective. Just as the bourgeoisie, especially the French, and some others, the Brits as well, sees power from the feudal and the religious states, which they were, everything changed, and the bourgeoisie became the world's superpower, to use today's terms. Now, 200 years later, the thing is in ruin, and all of the nice phrases and the sorts of things that amplify capitalism are just so much, in my view, nonsense. Because the bottom line is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The benefits are shrunk and reshrunk, and the whole thing becomes now, I think, poisonous.
Do you have a question for our guest today?
I think there is an implicit question there, Bill.
Yes.
I mean, I think I was talking about how successful the system we've got. Capitalism is the only really successful economic system and social system that's been devised. But I wonder if, in turn, I might take issue with the caller and says he's a Marxist. Well, there really is an example of a failed ideology. We can look. We saw the total collapse of the Soviet bloc economies. They simply couldn't sustain themselves, and their standard of living was abysmally low, far, far lower than in America or Britain or France or Germany or wherever. And we saw a very direct competition between in West Germany and East Germany. That before the Second World War, East Germany was actually more industrialized than the West. Its standard of living was higher in East Germany than in West Germany. And by 1989, the East Germans were paupers compared to what had happened in the West. So we actually had, very unusually for economics, almost a controlled experiment, almost as if we'd been in a scientific laboratory, and we could test out in Germany between the Western-type systems and the Marxist centrally planned systems. And we can see very, very decisively what happened there. Sometimes things do succeed.
I want to take issue with that.
Yeah, I would like to return here. This is our caller from Charleston. And please go ahead if you have a follow-up.
Yes, I do. The difference between what happened in Eastern Europe, in Russia especially, and then what was known as their satellites were fewer than the concept of internationalism. Hello?
Yes,
I'm here.
Please
yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What was in the Eastern Bloc was not international by any stretch of the imagination, and they had not the means nor the extend the process internationally. Therein lies the difference. in religious times and in feudal times, monarchs and all that stuff, there was an international perspective to their what they did, especially the Greeks and the Romans. And then when anything fails to become international, whether it's through mishandling, whether or not, and on top of that, I want to reiterate that the Soviet Union and those satellites were not communist. They were Stalinist for the most part. The real communists had already died. And hence they could not influence the process of history in that part of the world, which was horribly backward. Whereas the United States, England, the United States, France, and the Western countries had advanced alongside of the bourgeoisie. And when they got power, and they had a ready-made shoe to put that foot in, and that's what occurred. There has never been, to date, any sort of communist or Marxist society that is international. You have the little experiments, the things that do occur, but there has not been, under any circumstances, an international paradigm.
Well, I mean, if I say, I mean, I rather thought the Soviet Union did try and influence international events, like, you know, with its satellite in Cuba. You know, it was always trying to influence European communist parties. You know, it had a very international perspective. There's something called, you know, the Comintern, the Communist International, run by the Soviet Union to extend its influence. But I'm just going to go back to the firm failure. Just before the First World War, three out of the largest 100 companies in the world were already in Russia. Russia was starting to industrialize. Russia was starting to become prosperous. And yet, obviously, these were nationalized when the Bolsheviks seized power in 1917, and living standards went backwards. And it seems to me, you know, from a scientific point of view, I mean, we're contrasting, let's say, what happened in the centrally planned economies in the Soviet bloc, and not the free market. I think that's a misleading term, because there's always been lots of regulations, if you like, hemming in the way the market works in the West, the market-oriented systems of the West. It's a very, very decisive victory for the West, whether it's, you know, the French or the Germans or Swedes or the Americans. You know, we just did so much better and delivered so many benefits to people, not just in material living standards, but in terms of leisure time, in terms of life expectancy, in terms of dramatic falls in infant mortality, however we measure it. So it's not just in material gains, it's in all sorts of quality of life. You know, our system proved to be decisively better.
Well, Paul, in the time we have left, I want to explore a little bit along the lines of our caller, the political assumptions in what you're saying. I mean, if we look deeper at what your book is about, it really accepts a view of knowledge by Friedrich Hayek, an economist whom you admire quite a bit, even call, I think, one of the most innovative thinkers of the 20th century. And once you've accepted a certain theory of what knowledge is, then you can get into what Thomas Sowell calls a conflict of visions. And by that I mean, under your vision of knowledge, justice is a process. It's a process that no one can master, and so we use things like markets and social traditions, whereas other views might look at justice as a result. So is there a political view that underlines your book, or do you look at this as purely empirical?
I mean, I suppose I'm English, so I'm an empiricist. But I think it's a very important question, and you're right. I mean, it's if you like, the, you know, why these things happen, the philosophical underpinnings are something which interests me greatly, and I do try to address these things in the book. And you're right, my view of knowledge is rather Hayekian. So my view is, in the sense that, you know, that progress takes place, you know, by evolutionary tests, by trial and experiment. Just in the same way, you know, it took us 10,000 years to discover liberal democracy and capitalism. You know, we tried lots of things before we found one that works. And that's how, in general, we make progress. But I think the point that it's a very important point that you're making there, saying, well, if that really is how things are, then you say, well, the outcome of almost any process has to be just because that's how it is. Well, I don't think that's completely true, because I think an important point I'm making in the book, particularly towards the end, is that the world isn't completely like biological evolution. The human and social world isn't completely like that, where things really do take place at random. We do seem to have a very small window, and it's a very tiny one, in our ability to influence what happens. And the benefits, the returns to a very small understanding of the world can be very substantial. Doesn't mean you'll always get things right, because by the very nature you won't do, but it increases your potential to influence things for good. And so, for example, you could see And I think this is, you know, I stopped doing predictions many years ago, if I could make one here. I think if we're thinking ahead, so, you know, a number of decades, I think we'll see different forms of states in the West. It doesn't mean the state won't be important, that the state won't be concerned with issues of equity and outcome, but they'll be trying to do it much more, if you like, by trying to influence individual behavior through, if you like, through rules or regulations, rather than through, you know, the huge bureaucracies which now characterize or come to characterize the Western economies in the public sector, you know, even in the United States. It's much, much bigger than it was 50 years ago, 50, 60 years ago. And I think that's the way we've got to move, to try and think of, rather than try and have massive state intervention in the forms of, you know, spending large amounts of money, employing large amounts of people in the public sector, is to try and become cleverer and think of, you know, ways in which we might try and influence individual behavior and move society in the right direction. So it doesn't mean that I'm not concerned about that. I adopt, if you like, the pure Hayek position of saying, you know, the outcome of any social process must be just because that's what's actually emerged.
Mm-hmm. But there is a rather deep root here, politically, that you believe there's a kind of unarticulated knowledge, a kind of tradition that passes down knowledge that no individual can hold all the information, and things have to arise in kind of Hayek's way in terms of spontaneous order. So I guess is that leading you in a certain political way?
I mean, the way I vote, I've always voted for parties in Britain, which, you know, by American standards, you know, are wildly left wing. You know, I voted for Tony Blair's Labour Party, for example, but on many of their policies, you know, by American Democrat standards, are wildly left wing. Uh-huh. And I greatly admire Blair himself. I think he actually you know, understands this intuitively, this deep problem with large planned systems and centralized bureaucracies.
Paul, I also wanted to just probe in the last minute here. I saw influences in your book of kind of Herb Simon's idea of bounded rationality and his terrible word of satisficing, which means using the information you have to make a decision. Did that inform you and in how you think about this?
Oh, absolutely. I think thinkers like, you know, you mentioned Hayek, Herb Simon, I think, who was also, you know, a really, you know, titanic thinker who made major contributions to think of social science or understanding the world and knowledge. So, yes, I mean, the ideas of bounded rationality, if you like, rationality, if you have the pure economist view of thinking about it, completely rational, isn't right. And we've got to bound it severely, and we've got to understand that, you know, we can't know everything and that things do fail, and sometimes we get unexpected success. But it's only, if I could finish on this, it's only by trying, it's only by experimentation and evolution and resulting failure that we find out what actually works. And that's the way I think Western societies and Western companies have evolved, and that's why we're proving to be such a successful system, because we do have this capacity to evolve and innovate.
Paul, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Okay, thanks very much.
I've been talking with Paul Omorod, author of Why Most Things Fail, Evolution, Extinction, and Economics. I'm Bill Hammack, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. The technical producer has been Henry Frayn, and the producer has been Harriet Williamson.